Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. And that's John McCormick there, Song to the Seals, and that's the opening track on tonight's Mystery Train, the Sunday night special, where we get someone to pick the music. And tonight, I'm really glad to say, it's Gavin Friday, and that was Gavin's first choice. Gavin, John McCormick, before we get into the Virgin Prunes and all the rest of it, yeah, where did McCormick come from in your life?
Well, I grew up in a household, my dad actually professed till the day he died that he didn't like music. I tried telling him that even plants like music, but he professed he didn't like music, so there was never a record player till I went out and bought one when I was around 11 or 12. Yeah. But I had the blessed to have an uncle, Paddy Hanvey, who was my godfather, who was the eccentric guy who went and joined the army, came back in the 60s from London with a harlot with dark hair, red lips and tight dresses.
Use the word harlot very casually there.
Yeah, that's how they called her, because she was sort of snazzy and sexy, actually. Yeah. Quite cool. But Paddy was sort of a jazzer and a loner. And I was his godson, but he would bring me on a Sunday to art galleries, and I'd have a bag of crisps and a bottle of Coke afterwards in a pub, Madigan's. But he'd also, up in his apartment where he lived in Pierce Street, he'd play music. And the music was John McCormick and Enrico Caruso. And I wasn't running out buying them, but it planted a real seed, which I sort of...
It very obviously was the beginnings of it for you, when you think about it now.
Before anything else, at home, there was no music at all.
You were lucky, weren't you, really, that man was there?
Yes. I mean, I did like him. And it opened up my eyes to art as well, and just conversation.
Yeah.
My own house was football, and it was the Pope. And Patrick Pearce. So
it'd be hard to fit them all into one room, but anyway, there you go. Your mother not into music either?
No. No, but I mean, she was into anything I was into eventually. I mean, she'd go around with a David Bowie badge 5 years later. But no, she, I do remember when she actually went out and bought an album, I think in the 80s, I'd left home, and it was something like Richard Clayderman, that piano thing, which may sound interesting, but I doubt it.
Yeah. Well, you're a big James Last fan, I know that.
Well, I like James Last, and even Liberace had some magic madness to the magic.
Well, no doubt some of these people will come up over the course of the evening, but just to establish your credentials, we're going to start with the Virgin Prunes, because this has to be attacked and done full on. There's no way of sneaking up on this. I'd be curious to know, and we maybe get to this as we go along, how you get from John McCormick to the Virgin Prunes, and that sort of development. If anybody wasn't around for the Virgin Prunes at the time, they have now entered the world, the kind of legendary, almost mythical, almost as if they didn't even exist, because they were so out there. And so, you know, and I'd love to know, and maybe we talk about it afterwards, where that would have come from. What do you want to play as your opening track from the Virgin Prunes?
I think even in 1980, this was dismayed and scorned at. But this is us trying to be commercial. It was actually myself and Dick trying to be the Velvet Underground.
The Virgin Prunes. Yeah, thank you. I forgot about that bit. The Virgin Prunes and a song called Sandpaper Lullaby. And that's from the first album, Gab, isn't it? There was an EP before that.
There was an EP, but it was from A New Form of Beauty, which eventually ended up as an album. But A New Form of Beauty, these are the days where we didn't believe in major companies. We didn't believe in albums. So we brought A New Form of Beauty as a 7-inch, a 10-inch, a 12-inch, a cassette, a live gig, a video and a book. Each released the first Friday of every month. We never got to the book or the video, but we got all the rest out. So that was the first 7-inch from A New Form of Beauty.
To discuss the kind of the formation of this band, and I must point out, Gav, this is kind of a birthday celebration for you because, you know, big birthday coming up on the 8th, a couple of days' time.
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to address the slightly shocking age you have just reached?
Well, that's nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah, everything's 40 years ago now. 60.
It's actually...
The big 6-0.
It's actually 39 years ago, exactly.
Yeah.
And in 2 days' time, I will be 60.
Good man. Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
And we'll be celebrating your music tonight as well as everybody else's. Now, the formation of the Prunes, that's a good example because on guitar there is Dick Evans,
mm-hmm.
brother of Edge.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads us into... And we'll dispense with this as quickly as possible because this has been written about so many times in books, the formation of U2 and all that scene, Lipton Village, all the rest of it. Just for the definitive version, what's your memory of that bunch of people? What happened? Why did you get together? What was so unique about that group of people that so much came from it, including U2?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, how I met Googie and Bono was because of David Bowie. And we sort of articulated that in the last tour, the Cedarwood Road tour. And the phone booth on Cedarwood Road, I grew up on Cedarwood Road, same road Bono and Googie grew up on.
Yeah.
But I lived in the cul-de-sac, the Catholic end it was called. And I lived in the cul-de-sac. And the Protestants and the Plymouth Brethren lived up the other end. But there was no phone booth. No one had telephones in the 70s.
Yeah.
So the phone booth was right outside Googie's. Now, you had a habit of in them days, like I was around 11 and a half, 12, say 12, going on, 12. And you would, when you go out to your friends or go anywhere, you would bring your albums with you. Number one, you might be playing them in your mate's house, but really what you're doing is, I have a David Bowie album and you don't. Mm. I into this weird guy, you're not. You haven't a clue. You're a boot boy and you're like, show anybody. So that's really what you were saying. But I was standing outside a telephone booth and Bono and Googie were sitting on the wall and said, would you lend us your Bowie album? And I went, no. And that started the relationship.
Now, when you talk about, you know, the Catholic end and the Protestant end, I know that refers specifically to your family and Bono's family and Googie's family. But is that just a light touch you put on it at this stage in your life? Or were you conscious of it then? Were you conscious that they were Protestants? And
Very. Yeah. I mean, very much. I mean, there was sort of a fear of them. The whole sort of run around the church 3 times at midnight and you'll see the devil if you talk to a Protestant type of crap that was going on. But Plymouth Brethren's, I was horrified of. Because what did my dad say? Plymouth Brethren, they were so bad they were kicked out of Plymouth. Like, so you had this, there was that whole hokey pokey thing. And they were different. They had more money than us. Well, the Protestants, not the Brethren. Sorry, I'm going into the correctness.
Yeah, but were you not just playing together as children on the street as well? I mean, were you not run into them beforehand, just kicking football or just knocking around?
You know, it's the biggest influence for me was actually hanging out with Protestants. It changed everything, and actually hanging out with people that ended up going to Mount Temple. The Catholics and the Christian Brothers were telling me, no, you can't wear earrings. You don't do this to your hair. Don't do that to your clothes. The Protestant says, great, you're wearing earrings. So I found it the reverse. The liberation of hanging out with these eclectic people of a different religion to me was actually really redemptive.
And musically, in terms of the group, you commented during that song being played that Dick Evans taught Edge how to play guitar.
He did, and not only that, sort of used to make Memory Men the echo chamber, little guitar effect. He would make special versions to make more interesting sounds. He was quite a technical genius, was Dick.
And were you ever in U2?
No.
Even for 5 minutes?
No.
Was Edge ever in the Prunes?
Edge is actually, the first time the Virgin Prunes ever played was, the Virgin Prunes was a name we had since around 1974. And we said we would form a band, Virgin Prunes, which is quite advanced because punk hadn't kicked in. I won't exactly go into what Virgin Prunes means on this show.
Please
but
don't.
We will again. But the first time the Virgin Prunes played was early 1978. It was in Sutton Town Hall, and it was the night that Feedback, who were you two then, yeah, who were called The Hype, were changing their name to U2. And we opened, and the backing band was Dick, Edge, Larry, Adam and Larry. And they were all covered with this mesh for... I worked in a meat factory at the time, where you'd actually, if you're sending carcasses out to be frozen, you'd put this mesh over them. So I put mesh over all the four U2, or three U2, four then, because Dick was in U2 for a while, or The Hype. And we played a 17-minute version of I Can't Get No Satisfaction, like slowed down to the pace of bomb, 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 bomb.
I like it.
And so you two and the Virgin Prunes did collide.
I'd say you were a big hit playing that. Let's play some Bowie. What do you want, Starman?
I think so. It's the one that started it all, didn't it?
Starman from David Bowie, the choice of Gavin Friday, who's with me tonight. Gavin's picking all the music. Gavin's big birthday coming up this week, so thought we'd invite him in to pick the tunes. We were talking about the Prunes there, Gavin, before the Bowie track, and how important David Bowie was to you. But you mentioned that gig, you know, putting mesh over the band and playing these, you know, bizarre, long, slowed down versions of tracks. And where did that come from? That kind of performance art, if you probably didn't call it that at the time, or Dada and all those things. Maybe you didn't know what that was at mm-hmm. the time. I don't know. But where did all those influences come from, do you think, and when?
I think, to be honest, like, you know, I got into David Bowie when I was around 12. I was sitting in the sitting room and I saw Top of the Pops, that first yeah. performance. And it sort of did change a lot. You know, it became a religion, like a god. And anything he mentioned in any book, any interview, lyric, whether it was talking about Jacques Brel to William Burroughs. I mean, a 12-year-old going, what's William Burroughs? Who's Jean Genet? Mm. And so he sort of sowed those seeds. And he was the diviner that opened all these doors. Suddenly you were reading books, trying to see films by Bunuel, reading about Dada. And you know how serious you are as a teenager, walking around like the age of 14 with Sartre in your hand, like a real sort of arsehole on one level. But it means everything to you
yeah.
when you're 14 or 15, is these books and the music and the philosophies, even though you don't know what the word philosophy means.
Yeah, but suppose it's a bit early, though, to be finding this stuff, because you won't really get it, will you, or appreciate it at that
well,
age.
Well, you know, I think there's an antenna in you. I remember, like, seeing Cabaret, the famous movie with Joel Grey and Liza Minnelli when I was around 12 or 13, and being fascinated by all of this. And then suddenly, 7, 8 years later, you hear real Brecht and Weill, and you start reading about the Weimar, and you go, I was always attracted to it. So I think there's an antenna in you where you don't understand. Of course I didn't understand Jean Genet. I thought it was, this is what the Jean Genie's about. Mm. And it was the name of the rose, and I nearly had a heart attack. Mm. You know, of course, but you do later. There's something tells you this is right or this is different.
And were the other fellas in the group, in the crowd, let's say, in Lipton Village, the whole thing, which involves so many people, were they also into this, or were you on your own as such, you know, because...
I was very much on my own. I was a bit of a loner at home, even though I was like the eldest of the family. And music really was, you know, my best friend. It was my saviour. The first people I started talking to about this sort of stuff was Bono and Googie. And I was probably the artier of them all.
Mm. I mean, and by far the most talented. the best looking.
We won't go there. I was the tallest anyway, I know that.
And then where did you get the kind of chutzpah then to perform in the way you did with the Prunes, and, you know, to wear the dresses and to throw blood all over the place and do all the stuff that you did? Who gave you kind of, you know, the go-ahead to go and do that?
Well, I came from, Dublin in the 70s is a very different place, and the early 70s especially. I came from a very right-wing, Republican, Irish Catholic family. I was born and bred into it, and it was religious upbringing all the way, the Christian Brothers. So that would spark rebel in any person with any sort of an inkling. But also, it was... You know, I was bullied a lot at school. Mm. I was put down, tortured, basically, because, like, well, I decided to get my ears pierced and I decided I liked David Bowie. And it was quite a threatening thing to embrace glam rock visually back then. Mm. So I don't know where I had this bravado from. It wasn't from my dad. My mum embraced it. She'd take the trousers in and sew the sucking sequins onto the jacket or whatever. So I had a really, really tough time as a kid. And when punk happened, I thought that David Bowie went to this university in the heavens of genius. And then punk happened and it said, you can start a band. You can do it yourself, make it up. And I went, okay. And I says, and you call me a puff? Well, wait till I get the Virgin Prunes going. Yeah. I'll show you what a dress is. I'll show you what a man is. I'll show you what religion is. Yeah. I'll show you. I'll basically kill you.
Well, somebody said to me once, said it was very tough to wear a dress in Ballymun in those days when you were a fella.
It was really tough. And I didn't wear a dress like Boy George.
Oh, I know.
This was very much, is he going to kill me or kiss me?
Yeah.
But I remember, like, I'd meet at the end at the bus stop and Bono and Googie says, oh, Jesus, don't wear the dress tonight, Gav. We just want to go out and have a good time at the gig. I said, I'm wearing the dress. Don't tell me what to do. I says, well, then we're going to get into a fucking fight. And it just happened. Bam, 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 on the bus. Because it was just, I grew up with that don't tell me what to do thing.
Did you consider yourself a provocateur? I mean, were you looking for trouble?
I was hurt and I was angry. And from being, believe it or not, I was a very shy young person. And I think just something clicked when I was about 16 and you're just fed up of being hit and being bullied. And I went, no,
okay,
I'm going to get you back with a hammer called the Virgin Prunes. So it was my revenge.
Another track from the Prunes, Gav, from If I Die, I Die. Which one do you want to hear?
Theme for Thought, which basically sums up exactly all this angst and why should I be like you is the main line.
Theme for Thought from Virgin Prunes. Gavin Friday with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. Just listening to that, Gav, you know, it doesn't sound dated, because it doesn't quite fit with the sort of punk feel of the times.
Yeah, it's very much. I mean,
it sounds like Public Image, if anything.
Well, they were Johnny Lydon and Public Image. The Sex Pistols opened the door for me, really. But Public Image, I was obsessed with. Yeah. I mean, their first three albums are still genius, I think.
But you must have been listening to other stuff apart from the kind of punk that was making it onto Top of the Pops, if you know what I mean.
I mean, I was listening to the punk that was going on Top of the Pops. I mean, I was a big fan of Buzzcocks, Susan the Banshees, blah, 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 Elvis Costello, whatever. Yeah. But I was really, really listening to Joy Division, Père Ubu, Cabaret Voltaire, the quirkier stuff, the more underground stuff.
But here's the thing. That's 1979, right?
Yeah.
Now, 1979...
Well, actually, we wrote it and played it in 1979. That came out about 2 years later.
Yeah.
But the first time we ever performed that was live on the Late Late Show in 1979. I think it's still, if you go to YouTube, and it was the same weekend that the Pope played his biggest gig in Ireland, which was the Sunday appearance in the Phoenix Park, John Paul II, live. And we played on the Friday night, and there was outrage.
And I wonder why.
And we were banned from performing on RTE for a year.
Well, what did you do to cause the outrage? Or was it just your very presence that was an outrage?
Well, as you heard, it was quite sort of aggressive and atonal. When we went in, everything was live in them days. We just did an acoustic version. I didn't scream. And we didn't wear makeup or mad clothes.
Yeah.
And then at 9 o'clock when we were going on air, we did. And we did a terrible thing. One of my oldest friends, you know her well, the great Sharon Blankson.
Oh, she's interviewed on that, isn't she?
Same
programme?
Well, do you know what?
She's in the audience or something.
She was on the stage with us smoking. And she was a punk rocker. And she was black.
Yeah.
And smoking. And you wouldn't believe the shock of that alone, with these guys screaming with makeup. So it was numerous things, the sexuality, the punk, and even, you know, imagine a black woman smoking, hanging out with punk rockers.
No, I mean,
the week the Pope came to Dublin.
I know you find that hard to believe, but when you look back in 1979, even young people were conservative. And I'm not surprised people were like, what is this?
Well, I remember when I first saw, it was weird. I'd seen David Bowie twice. I saw him in 1976, saved up, got a boat and train, slept in the train station and went to see him in Earl's Court.
What age were you then?
16.
Yeah.
And I slept in sleeping bags. And I did it also in 78 for the Heroes Tour. But then the terrorist campaign got so bad, sleeping in train stations was barred around 1980, I think. So it was a great thing because I saw a lot of gigs. But I remember queuing up to see David Bowie for the Station to Station tour, and feeling like the biggest arsehole alive, because I was a thick paddy that had long hair still. Mm. I'd seen these exquisite young men and women all in different phases of the Thin White Duke. But I remember turning around and outside of pub, seeing a gang of men, young boys and girls. And I went, they looked like Ziggy post the apocalypse. Mm. And I went, what's that? Who are they?
Yeah.
And it was punks. And then the next week in the NME, which is a Bible in them days, it says, new underground scene happening, punk rock. And I went, I want to see this. Yeah. So I used to get the boat and train and go to gigs in Liverpool, Leeds, in 77, 78. Wow. So I was experiencing punk as it was happening
in
Britain.
As it was happening, yeah. Because most of us who did eventually see some of those bands, it was long over by the time we saw them.
Punk
cases.
Was over in 78, truthfully.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of new wave and pop and rock kicked in.
Yeah.
In a good way, but punk was quick.
I think we should play the Pistols, eh?
Anarchy in the UK.
Anarchy in the UK. Time to bring it out again, I would think. There's a couple of things, Gavin, about that. Apart from the observation that the Virgin Prunes track earlier on, you did sound a lot like a mix between David Bowie and Johnny Lydon.
Exactly. I mean, when you played theme for thought, I went, oh my God, there's a young man that doesn't know if he's Bowie or Rotten. And you show your influences very, very strongly when you're young.
But the other thing about that, when you listen to it, apart from there's still strange vocals of Johnny Rotten. They still sound like weird, or not weird, but they still sound...
There's conviction.
Yeah, but they sound so much different. They sound different to what a vocal is, inverted commas, supposed to be.
Yeah.
But other than that, you have a very slickly produced rock and roll band mm-hmm. playing Gene Vincent numbers, yeah. really. Yeah. So have you in the meantime ever kind of reassessed what that punk thing was about? Because those Pistols records still sound very good. Well, largely because they're produced by the same guy
who's producing
Roxy Music.
But you listen to The Clash's first album and it sounds really rough.
Talking of The Clash, it's come up a few times with people that we've interviewed on this Sunday night. One of the most seminal gigs for music lovers in Ireland, of my vintage certainly, was this The Clash gig, you know? Yeah. Were you at it, were you not? I was too young to be at it. You actually played that gig.
Yeah, we opened for The Clash in the top hat in Dunleary in 1978. I told you about U2 backing us in early 1978, but late 1978, we played the project, our first official gig, with our own lineup, the full band lineup, in September. And some promoters saw us and said, will you open for The Clash? Which we did, but we only lasted 10 minutes on the stage.
We don't have to get into all the detail of this, but your trousers exploded.
My trousers exploded, yeah. And I had no underwear on. And then Googie's dress ripped, and they sussed it wasn't a girl, it was a bloke. And between bottles and the curtains being set on fire, yeah. These are the days you'd have curtains at venues. Yeah, yeah. And then The Clash actually fecked us out and wouldn't pay us. And we were standing outside the rain with our at a bus stop trying to 46A back from Dunleary.
So much for the punks, eh? We move along musically, Gav, too. Each man kills a thing he loves. And I'm just wondering how you got from being the front man in this art rock group. Let's put it that way. That's a good enough term for it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Art rock.
Well, you know what? People say you're a bit arty, and I go, what's wrong with art?
I know, but art rock suggests more Roxy Music than Virgin Prunes in a way, doesn't it? Yeah, I mean, you weren't an art college crowd.
We weren't, but it was almost like we were. Like, some of our gigs were actually installations and performances.
Yeah. Yeah.
Weirdly enough, myself and Googie did paint and did love art. And I actually, you know, when we were on tour, if we had a day off, we'd be in the Prado Museum walking around. The rest of the lads would be in the pub. Mm. Myself and Googie, we did like art.
Mm.
And the Virgin Prunes really was our university. So it was there was this myth in your head that you had to confront and you had to keep pushing the barriers further and further. We used to play for no longer than 20 minutes. And then we'd never do an encore. As soon as people used to walk away after the 20 minutes, they won't come back. And then we says, oh, they now let's play encores as they're halfway out the venue. And they'd all run back. So we were just, there was that sort of perverse, let's mess with everything. It was really, as you said, like punk exploded, imploded. I find the period 78 to 82 really interesting in music from Europe and America, and especially England. But where we were embraced, the Virgin Prunes were more embraced in Europe, especially France and Germany. And we used to tour France for like 3-4 weeks, like literally around the whole country. Mm-hmm. And that's where I started hearing things like chanson. And I knew about Brel through Bowie and through Scott Walker. But then I actually saw, I remember this journalist interviewed the Virgin Prunes. And afterwards, he took us out for dinner and he says, no, you're going to have to come back. And he showed me video of Jacques Brel's last performance in Paris. And it was like seeing, in a different level, Bowie for the first time or Johnny Lydon for the first time. Mm. And everything changed again.
Well, let's play the Brel. And after that, straight after that, we play Each Man Kills the Thing He Loves. Okay, this is Au Suivant, Jacques Brel.
Au suivant, tout nu dans ma serviette.
La 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 la
Each Man Kills the Thing He Loves from Gavin Friday, and The Man Caesar from the album Each Man Kills the Thing He Loves. Before that, Au Suivant from Jacques Brel. Gavin Friday's with me in studio tonight picking all the tunes. Gavin, that was 1989.
Mm-hmm.
That relationship with, how did you get really from the point of, it's okay saying Jacques Brel blew me away and I was into this and I was into that and all these influences and so on, but mm-hmm. forget to get from The Virgin Prunes to making this album with, sorry, it's still going on in the background, to make this album with Island Records and all of that, with the musicians you have on here, Michael Blair and Fernando, and you've got Bill Frisell, Mark Rebo's on this record, mm-hmm. you know. That's impressive stuff. And it's a big, I'm not trying to in any way denigrate the Prunes, but this is a big step up into the serious professional world of music,
yeah.
properly played. You know what I mean?
Well, it was really Hal Wilner, the producer. I mean, the Virgin Prunes they sort of imploded on themselves and really ended. It started ending in 84, 85, I got miserable, and 86, I left. It was gone. And from 86, really, I painted for a year or two with Googie. And we actually did a vegetable round. We used to sell apples and carrots to people out in Tala in a van, Gavin and Googie. Seriously, back in the day.
And was that a serious enterprise in terms of making a wage, or was it just another piece of installation art as far as you're concerned?
No, actually, we actually had to eat. It was actually about food.
So they were actual carrots, yeah.
Yes, yeah. They were. But really, and then I started this club in Dublin around the late 86, 87 called the Blue Jesus, which was sort of a burlesque cabaret and delving in the music that was meaning something to me. I felt betrayed by punk and I was bored by the 80s. Everyone goes on about the 80s. It was pretty horrific what was going on. Just even politically, we have a sense of this Brexit. But you imagine Maggie Thatcher. It was like that every day of your life when she was in control. That horrible woman who destroyed everything. Well, that's what it was all the time. And the music, you know, Duran Duran weren't that great. They really were like a bad David Bowie boy band. Yeah. And I don't care. I still don't like them. So the 80s were
It's okay, Gavin, you can say that here.
No, but everyone's embracing the crap of the 80s. And you can. But I was going, it's all about chanson and it's about this. And then I'd gone to New York. And I'd seen the downtown, the sort of the Rebos, the dysfunctional sort of, it's jazz, but it's punk, but it's not, but it's this. And it was like seeing something really I'd never experienced, like going to England in 76 and seeing punk for the first time. And I met the great Hal Wilner, who became, and still is, I call him my metal guru. He's another diviner for me, what he's opened me up to. And then suddenly he says, yeah, actually, we are going to get Frizzell and Rebo and Blair to play on this album.
In Dublin, though, when you're talking about chanson and cabaret and all the rest of it, you would have had a few soulmates there already. There was Aggie Burnell, mm-hmm. Philip Chevron, Mr. Pussy. There were people around. You know,
well, the weirdest thing is Agnes Burnell,
her
daughter, Antonia, was great friends of Googie and used to be a big Virgin Prune fan. And Agnes came to see the Virgin Prunes to understand what her young daughter was into and captivated by. And she came and loved the Virgin Prunes and came up to the dressing room and invited us for tea in Sandymount. After tea in Sandymount, she handed me a cassette of Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht's The Threepenny Opera, 1978. And then a week or two later, after a McGonagall's gig, I'd Phil Chevron knocking on the door, going, let's meet up for a drink. Do you like Brecht? Do you like Brel?
Yeah.
And I was, you know, and he says, but Gavin, read Bean. And I mean, yes, but like Phil Chevron, he's legendary now.
Yeah.
There hasn't been many Aggies or Phils. But yeah, it was there in a very eclectic and beautiful way.
So when you formed the club, the Blue Jesus, mm-hmm. What would be a typical night? What would the repertoire be of an evening?
Well, Agnes performed numerous times. It was quite an effort to get her on the stage because she was quite old at the time. I had this philosophy that when people drink, they want to talk. They don't. They like music, but they don't really want to listen to music all the time. Yeah. So it was like a sort of, I called it the Blue Jesus. So it was a pun on the Blue Angel, the Marlene Dietrich book and the film, except it was a big blue Jesus Christ sitting on the table. There'd be 20 minutes of music, and then there'd be 40 minutes of no music, where people could just drink and smoke and talk. These are the days you could smoke and talk, and there was no VIP, there was no guest list, there was £2 in and that's it. And I was MC, I'd sing one song, and I'd bring up other musicians, but I had a law that no one could play any of their own songs, and you had to perform cover versions before nothing later than 1950. So it was challenging, yeah. You know, old folk songs, jazz, like Cole Porter, Brecht, anything.
Perfect.
And it was great. It became, I mean, everyone from McGowan to Sinead to anyone who's anyone. And comedians. I remember, God bless him, Sean Hughes, who passed away, his first gig ever was in the Blue Jesus. Aidan Walsh, God help us, his first gig ever was the Blue Jays. But McGowan was a big fan and performed many times. And yeah, so and like all wonderful things, when the spontaneity went, I pulled the plug.
How did you translate all of that, you know, feeling, vibe, passion, the rest of it, into a record deal? Into having something presentable to give to a record company and say, here, what do you think of this?
I'd met up when in the Blue Jays. I remember saying, I need somebody that knows more than three chords, and I need someone that's piano based. And Bono said to me, actually, there was a guy in my class, Morris Roycroft, and I know his whole family were classically trained. And I was going, oh, I'll meet him. Interesting. Then I said, the name will have to go. Roycroft. So that was the first problem. I mean, these things meant a lot to you when you're younger and still do. I'm not having that. Friday Roycroft doesn't sound right. So his mother's maiden name is Caesar, hence the man Caesar. But I met Morris and it was fantastic because he sort of punk bypassed him. And he knew these chord changes. He knew how Kurt Weill was able to play those songs. And we were doing covers of Brecht and Brel and even Roxy Music stuff and that. And it was wonderfully refreshing for me. So it was like going back to college again and learning. So and how I got the deal was we did a demo. We did a demo of four songs, and then not really demos because you end up just overdubbing them.
Yeah.
But I was in New York. I was actually working with U2 on a show, and I set up five meetings with five different companies, just to go in. But the first person I met was Chris Blackwell, and we spoke for 3 hours. He never played anything. And he says, come with me. I want you to meet a man. We went to a place called SOB's, Sounds of Brazil. Yeah, yeah. Cecilia Cruz was playing. And Hal Winner was sitting at the bar. And he says, you hang out with this man. And if you get on, I'll sign you.
Wow.
And that's how it happened. And we got on and still have got on for the last 30, 40 years. But that's, and Chris Blackwell just said, I love the way you talk.
I tell you, I'm sure record companies don't work like that.
By the way,
anymore.
They don't. And I had to live with the English label and the rest of the label. And Chris, I was one of Chris's golden boys. But this is interesting about Chris Blackwell. He signed Tom Waits.
Yeah.
He signed Tricky. He signed Marian Faithful. He signed Gavin Friday. Other than that type of music, he liked reggae. Yeah. He hated U2.
Really?
Yes. He got into them later. I'd say he did.
I liked it so much I bought the company, yeah. Mm. We'll take a break, we'll be right back. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. The night we get someone in to pick the tunes tonight, it's Gavin Friday. He's 60 this week, so we thought we'd get him in and go through the whole thing. Just before the break, Gav, we're talking about you getting this record deal with Island Records.
Mm-hmm.
What was your expectation or hope at that point?
I didn't have expectations. I just knew what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I met Chris Blackwell. I'd met five or six companies, but it was Chris Blackwell who signed me. Signed me without even listening to the music, just liked me. But then I had to deal with the record company in Britain, and it was really tough because, you know, in 1989, it was all pop and rock was... It wasn't even... Nirvana hadn't even kicked in.
Yeah.
The sort of new punk hadn't even come in. But Europe was the godsend because the seeds I'd sown in the Virgin Prunes, they were still there. We're not, they absolutely adored Each Man Kills.
Yeah.
Holland, Belgium, France, Germany. And still to this day, as I turn 60, it's basically is my backbone.
Well, let's play a track from... Adam and Eve. That was the second one then, was it?
Adam and Eve came around 92. Yes, it was the second solo album.
Hal Wilner again. And Flood.
And Flood. And a guy called Dave Bascombe yeah. For his sins.
Okay. Let's have a track from Adam and Eve. Which one will we play?
The one I do with a very brilliant singer who's been missing in action for years is Maria McKee and myself, Falling Off the Edge of the World.
Falling Off the Edge of the World, Gavin Friday from the album Adam and Eve with Maria McKee there. It's great to hear her voice again because she's just a
phenomenal talent.
That's pop music, Gavin.
Hmm?
That track we just heard, that's pop music.
About the Kuwait War and Iraq. So it didn't really make the charts.
It is nevertheless pop music. Yeah. So I'm working up to a song called Angel, which is... I guess your best known song. Mm-hmm. How did you enjoy being in that scene? You know, record companies looking for your next album and all that kind of stuff.
No, I mean, I never ran with the conveyor belt thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the last album I brought out was about 8 years ago,
yeah.
And I'm about to bring one out in a year or so. Yeah. So, and that's because there's life there. Yeah. I've lived 8-9 years. I've something to write about. When you go on the road for a year and a half and you're supposed to bring another album out and you've been basically on the road, it's okay when you're 20.
Yeah.
But nah, I mean, I didn't fit into Island Records the way they wanted to.
Yeah.
And I was kicking against, I mean, that song, Adam and Eve was a very eclectic, showing Each Man was adored by the critics in Europe. And it had that influence of, you know, Brel and chanson and very New York downtown and meets this sort of burlesque. And I sort of went, don't put me in a box.
Mm.
I also like pop and rock. Mm. And it just confused everyone again.
And I'm sure when you started telling them that you like Brendan Behan and Oscar Wilde and John McCormick and all the rest of it, that would have thrown them into even further confusion.
Even further. And then, you know, the album I went on to make, Shag Tobacco, where I was writing songs about Enrico Caruso, who my uncle introduced me to 38 years earlier. I actually am proud to say I've always sort of done it my way.
Mm.
I mean, Island Records dropped me after Shag Tobacco, but it didn't bother me.
Which was the album with the hit on it.
Yeah, but I didn't know it was a hit. And we didn't make... I've never in my life gone out to make a hit.
Mm.
I've never gone out to make money. I'm not, maybe the vegetable round.
Yeah.
Maybe then we actually had to go out, let's make money. But what happened really was around the time before Shag Tobacco, around the time of Adam and Eve, Jim Sheridan came along to me and asked me to work with him on a film called In the Name of the Father. And I was sort of his advisor, musical advisor. And we got on so well. He says, yeah, you could write songs like that. How do you make a bomb go off? How would you and Morris make a bomb go off musically? Can you do that? Anyway, the bomb went off and it was called In the Name of the Father.
Why don't we play that one now?
Yeah.
In the Name of the Father, music from Gavin Friday, Maurice Caesar.
Yeah, and Bono.
Bono, of course, on vocals on that, and the Jim Sheridan movie, which is a very kind of, was a pivotal moment, wasn't it, that movie? We hadn't seen anything like that before.
No, I mean, it's 93, I think, 94, correct me, I don't know, late 93. It was first Ireland suddenly standing up to Britain and going, no, no more. And, you know, that's why Bono jumped aboard. He heard, he saw roughs of the album, of the cut of the movie, heard what we were writing and says, I want in. And when we were working on the closing track, Sinead heard it, I want in. Because the story of the Guildford Four and then the Birmingham Six, it was, you know, I'd walked for two things, marched for two things in my life. It was the Guildford Four and the X case. And that was the country was changing. It was standing up going, no, you know, okay, another 5 years, divorce, got in or whatever. But it was really the change around that period. And people like Jim Sheridan and Neil Jordan were making extraordinary films. I mean, extraordinary films.
And the sound of that music, when you think about it, particularly at the end, it's the Virgin Prunes back again. It's that sound.
You know, we took trad instruments, but we put them through amps and feedbacks and distortions. There's fiddles, there's accordions, and we have Bowrons and Lambegs beating the crap out of each other. Yeah. So it was conceptually that in the head, but it was that anger, that sort of punk rock again.
Yeah. Different mood, Angel. People will know that from Romeo and Juliet if they don't know it from your album.
Yeah.
It's important for an artist, isn't it, if you get associated with a big movie like that, and the song becomes the sound of the film in some way.
Yeah, and it was Baz Luhrmann who is a big fan and asked, could he have Angel? He heard a rough mix of it, and you know, once again, we didn't plan. I always believe, I said this to you when we were playing the other tracks, Sandpaper Lullaby, which we wrote like in 1978, and it's me trying to sing falsetto. And here, like 20 years later, 50, I'm singing. Oh, I can sing falsetto. But I have this feeling that most writers or singers or musicians, they write five songs and they keep rewriting them or trying to finish them properly. So when I hear Angel, I can hear Sandpaper Lullaby like 20 years later in my head.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to go back now and listen to Sandpaper Lullaby and see where it is. But I was surprised, actually, when you played Sandpaper Lullaby at the top of the show, I was surprised at how easy it was to listen to. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
In my head, everything the Prunes did was like getting your heads
Well, there is.
And
there
it's
is,
not.
There's
you know?
A lot of mad stuff. Exactly. And I deliberately went, you know, the big thing, a lot of journalists, sure, they can't even play. Sure, there's no music. Well, I tell you, put on a Virgin Prunes album, it'd be a lot better than some of the 80s crap you've had at home, baby.
That's Angel from Gavin Friday. Gavin's with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks. Beautiful. I love that song. Now, I'm trying to see where we're going to go next. One of the things, you know, you talked about Jim Sheridan saying, you can write this kind of stuff. Did you know you could write music? I mean, did you have musical chops? Did you know chords? Did you know notes? Did you
Morris. Know? Morris really was my musical chops. I mean, I have a big melodic ear. And I know what I like, and I know I'm around music, so I can write.
Yeah.
But Morris was sort of this sort of, it was like a sort of a Cole Porter from the north side of Dublin.
So would you, you know, would you typically, I don't know, hum a tune?
Oh, yeah. It's quite organic. I mean, Angels started with a bass line.
Yeah.
You know, and Morris actually had the bass line. And then the
a
melodies
very, a very
came in.
1980s bass line, I have to say.
Well, that was Tim Simonon, the great producer, who he'd met through In the Name of the Father. But what was great about Jim was Jim loved taking risks. And it was during the time of working with him on The Name of the Father as an advisor. I mean, helping him with the score. But there was a guy called Trevor White doing the score. And then he just said, look, you make a bomb musically, you and Morris. and make this song at the end that breaks your heart, which was Thief Your Heart with Sinead, came aboard. But Jim then went and he says, I think you can do a whole score for a whole movie and bring in an orchestra and work with a 40-piece orchestra. And truthfully, myself and Morris were shitting ourselves, but it was like, once again, going back to university for me.
Mm.
And so much so, like, Shag Tobacco came out 96, and it was like 14, 15 years later, before I brought out another album of songs.
Mm.
And I just went into the world of score for many, many years.
So you could, some piece of music which ends up being played by a full orchestra could begin with you literally humming a melody that you've...
It could, or it could be just a tiny piano refrain.
Yeah.
I mean, we brought in orchestrators and people to learn us and educate us, but it's like what I've learned is, I mean, one of the most challenging shows I've ever done in my life was when I worked with Scott Walker, who had a 40-piece atonal, out-of-tune orchestra and 60-piece jazz outfit, and you're in there trying to, you know, trying to get going. But having worked in the score music for the last, it gave me the chops to actually even stand up against Tilt and The Drift.
Okay, let's play one from The Boxer, and then I want to talk to you about some of the other projects as well, some of the other things, including that one. Music from the movie The Boxer. It's called The Peace Line. Music by Gavin Friday and Morris Caesar. Gavin Friday with me in studio tonight. We're kind of marking Gavin's big birthday this week. So, and we're working our way through a lot of great tunes. Apart from just the tunes, Gav, you ended up in the movies. And I must admit, we were all amazed at how easily you seemed to take to this form. Which was the first one?
Well, the first, I did a tiny thing in a Kirsten Sheridan movie. I think it was Cillian Murphy's first movie called Disco Pigs.
Yeah.
And I play a sort of Dublin tracksuit, sort of with a bad moustache, basically just a yob down in Cork, DJ and doing a mobile disco. Pascal Stankard, I think I called myself in it. But we were working on the score and she just asked me to try this role. But Neil Jordan asked me to be in Breakfast on Pluto. And I was very good friends with Pat McCabe, the writer. I actually did big radio session, big radio series here called Emerald Germs of Ireland. Mm. Myself and Morris scored them about 10 episodes. So we really had been creative together. And Breakfast on Pluto, he wrote soon after we first met. And subliminally, there's a little bit of Virgin Prune in there anyway. The kitten Cillian character has a little bit of Gavin Friday about him. I actually, you know, it's dedicated to me anyway, the book. So, but I didn't think I would have sexually ambiguous IRA gun running cover version doing the Indian, basically a homage to the Indians, Billy Hatchet. So as a 46-year-old singing Wigwam Bam, and trying to get off with a transgender 22-year-old. I didn't think that was ahead of me in my mid-40s. So I was blessed to be with Cillian. He's such a great guy. And, you know, I'd sort of had been around there. You sort of live what you are. So I had been in the Virgin Prunes and I knew.
And you were also, I mean, a lot of what you did on stage involved and still involves acting, doesn't it? Before, you mentioned Joel Grey earlier.
Yeah.
Through your good offices, they actually met once, which is kind of astonishing. But you know, there was the performance that you do involves acting. You're probably learning how to act as you went along.
Yeah, I mean, much more so than even like when people say Bowie was a theatrical influence. I think, going back to say with Brel, the physicality of Brel and how he sort of performs, if you watch film of him, I never saw the man live, and it's sort of, and then even Brecht and Weill, and I always knew in The Virgin Prince, when we couldn't play that well, we actually learned how to play, and then we broke up. I would let the theatre and the visual that myself and Googie would get up to tell the story as well as the lyric. So it's always been in us, in me. And, I mean, the Brecht show I did literally a week and a half ago in Dublin, I didn't just play it. I became the characters from the plays and from the musicals.
Gavin, I want to talk about some of the other projects that you get involved in. You mentioned the Scott Walker one.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been many like that. How do you... I suppose it depends who it is, but it must be great to be asked to do something like that with someone like Scott Walker.
Well, it really took me aback. I didn't expect it. I mean, I work a lot with Hal Wilner, who is this musical genius that puts a lot of eclectic shows. He did the infamous Leonard Cohen, Two Nights in the Point way back. Yeah. Nick Cave, Lou Reed, everyone there. Mary Margaret, phenomenal cast. And but this came in from Scott Walker. And he was a fan of the Virgin Prunes. And he loved he loved what I did. And it was myself, Jarvis Cocker, and Damon Albarn. And the rest were all classical or opera singers. And he didn't sing, but he was on every musical note.
Yeah.
He was there, overseeing and looking and not speaking, with the glasses and the hat.
Yeah.
And it was quite amazing and quite an honour, because I absolutely adore Tilt as an album. And that used to sound like the end of the world, but now you listen to it, and to me it sounds like a pop album. You know, it's the way things change, you know.
The Gavin Bryars projects, you've done quite a few of those. The Shakespeare one in particular is one I'd like to hear more of.
We've never really recorded it. Gavin Bryars approached me about 12 years ago, and we did a musical interpretation of the sonnets with his ensemble. He asked me to write a version of a sonnet, contemporary. I think he asked about four contemporary artists. I know that Anthony Hegarty, or Annie, he calls himself, or she, wrote one. I did. But the Shakespearean people liked my narrative tone, and they asked me to be the main narrator. And
this was the RSC, wasn't it?
Yes. I've done this show twice a year for the last 12 years with Gavin, around the world.
I'd like to hear it, though. Well, can we get this released in some way?
Well, he does. We haven't gone in and recorded it. We've recorded it live, but we've never released it. But I'm sure we'll see it today.
The other thing you do, which will be of interest to our listeners, is you call it midwifing when you go off with the U2 on the road, when the tour is getting up and running, and obviously for a long time before it starts.
Yeah.
But you're the man with the clipboard walking around going, "That's not working, boys. That is working, boys."
Yeah, and weirdly enough, it's what I've always done.
Yeah.
I mean, when I lived on Cedarwood Road and we were learning to write songs for the first time, and Bono would play me, "Listen to this. It's called I Will Follow." And I go, "Yeah, well, the chorus isn't good enough. Yeah, or double the middle eight. Or why is it so slow?"
Yeah.
So it's always been, and he'd be the same with me. Mm. And I think it was really around when they became what they were, the biggest band in the world, come Joshua Tree. And he rang me up and he said, I need you over here. He says, "They're all blowing smoke up me. I don't believe any of them. You tell us as it is. And we're in very big gigs and everyone telling me I'm great." And I says, "Well, no better, man." So it sort of organically just evolved. Yeah. And what I've learned, again, as a performer, as a writer, and as a vision, what my vision is, what I've learned from them is phenomenal.
Yeah, but you're not the man to ask this. You won't answer this, but I think they've learned an awful lot from you. Maybe you will answer that. But they have learned a lot from you as well, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, but people forget to, you are still just a bunch of mates who still happen to be together as mates, which is quite unique.
Yeah, still.
Not many mates are together as tight for as long as you guys are.
I think what kept that friendship going is that we actually like working together, me and Bono. And when men find work they like, it's very rare that happens. I am very maternal about them, you know, and I'm very heavy to them. But I love them as well. But I don't want to be them. Do you know what I mean? I make music like I'm playing tonight. If I sounded like them, I'd be in big trouble. So, and I've no ambitions. I don't want to play Crow Park. I mean,
except for the Dubs, maybe. Lord, I'm Coming is an amazing song from your album, the Gavin Friday album, Catholic.
Yeah.
Which was, I think it's your best album. But then I haven't heard the new one yet.
Which is coming very soon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This, you went deep on this record.
You know what? It was interesting. Maybe I only make music when things are going badly in the economy or the world. But during the whole Celtic Tiger boom, Jesus, I ran from Dublin. Like, I was afraid of my life or what was coming out culturally. So I hid and hid in Hollywood with Score and stuff and Gavin Bryars projects. But this happened, and it's sort of, I think the death of my father really brought it together. And it was, as I was saying when I was earlier, I had a very dysfunctional relationship with my dad, but we made up just before he died, which is such a beautiful thing, because to go around with that pain that you had for like 40, 50 years of your life and not make up. So really, lads out there our age, get over it. If you're not talking to the dad, talk to them, because it is such a relief. Something went off my back that was sitting there for 40 odd years and a bad relationship with my dad. And a lot of this album is about loss and coming to terms with loss. And there's a song, we're not going to play this one, but you actually play on it, Blame. And no one's to blame. We all mess up in life. And your father doesn't mean to be a bollocks. Sorry, we'll have to leave that one in.
But the thing was, you know, you made a good point, because it was almost too late when you made it up with them. I mean, it was at the end, wasn't it?
Yeah. He had the heart attack.
Yeah.
And he had the heart attack and apologised. But it meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
So
this is Pascal we're talking about. You mentioned Pascal Stankard earlier on. So Pascal Hanvey.
Pascal, it was deliberate, yeah.
Pascal Hanvey.
But the big song in this is Lord, I'm Coming. And I'd gone through a lot in this period, a personal loss and change. And I wanted to get that feeling, because music is incredibly... I was saying that, like, as a kid, before I met my friends, I was this loner listening to everything on radio and buying my little stereo and reading. And that moment of, like, when you lose a lot and you actually don't know if you're going to kill yourself or give yourself to God or something, and you're in this nowheresville, and music comes in and saves you and opens a light. And I wanted to capture that feeling, and that was the striving thing about Lord, I'm Coming, is that sort of nowheresville, but there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Lord, I'm Coming from Gavin Friday from the album A Catholic. We've time for one more, Gav.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, your lovely mum has gone too, a woman I knew, and, you know, a beautiful woman. And as a result of that, there's lots. I mean, we all lose our parents. I've lost mine as well. But you kind of, it does change you dramatically, doesn't it? You kind of grow up, no matter what age you are.
Yeah, I mean, I lost my mum 2 years ago, and, you know, I never loved anyone like I loved her. And she was always there for me. Like, when she wore Virgin Prune badges to Superquinn, because people would point and say, And there's your woman. She makes the dresses for them. And she says, give me a badge. They're all talking about me. So she's a little bit of punk herself.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And it comes out. I mean, there's a little bit of rage about her dying because she had the horrible, horrible, disgusting disease called Alzheimer's, where it's the invasion of the body snatcher. The spirit and the soul of your loved one is gone. So it's not like the dad and the heart attack. This is like 7 years of hell. And everyone goes, oh, the beautiful days. They're not beautiful. They're absolutely crap. And I was angry with losing my mum. There's a little bit of that on the new album. And
this new album of yours, when's that going to be out?
The new album that I'm currently working on, I mean, I hope to have it mixed by the end of the year. I'd say this time next year, next September.
Will you play that record to you too first, the way they would probably play their music to you first, for a kind of an approval that you would like
to
get?
No, I near the end.
Yeah.
Near the end, never at the top.
Yeah.
You know, but I'd play it. It's like as you go to mix it, and then he says, that's a shit couplet, you know, and I go, ooh, he's right.
Yeah.
And I'd go back to school and rewrite. But that's the ping pong we've always done. But this album, I'm actually really enjoying it. I'm just enjoying, and the world we're in, like you said about the loss of my mum, and there's anger there with the Alzheimer's. And basically, my mum had a tough time with my dad. She's got a few years of freedom, and she gets Alzheimer's, so I was angry. But like, I look at the world now, you know, I'm a few years older than you, and I've seen it pretty mental in the 70s growing up. But this is the maddest time I've ever seen in my life. I don't know what's going to happen next year with Ireland and England. I don't know what's happening to America. The beacon to us all as kids, the great dream, the dream maker, has a madman. And you go, and I have to write about this. And I actually think there's something wrong with any musician or writer or poet that isn't writing about the crap that's going on in this world at the moment.
And you're not going to hear it in the charts. Bad and all as things were back in the day, the old Bob Dylan song would make it into the charts or something. Yeah. Some kind
what
of comment.
What is this?
Nothing's happening.
You know, there's a little bit of hope when you hear young Dublin bands like the Fontaines DC. Mm. I says, oh my God, he's writing a lyric.
Yeah.
And he's dub. And it's Get Out of Me Way. And the Murder Capital. There's a little, but I mean, even if you mention the word, that red-headed hobbit thing, that makes loads of records.
I mean, it could be any red-headed hobbit we're talking.
It
could be anybody.
There's many of them.
Your last choice, Gavin, is what?
One of my, away from the great Morris Caesar, who I don't work with and haven't worked with in a good while, but one of my longest collaborators who I started working with again, I have two collaborators. One of them is the great Kate Ellis, who was on your show recently.
Yeah.
And I've worked with her now for 20 years nearly. And Renaud Pion, the French multi-instrumentalist who plays horns and clarinets. And I've worked with him for nearly 30 years. But he's come back and he's all over the new album. But he formed a band a year and a half ago. We brought out an album called Atonalism. And it's Atonalist featuring Gavin Friday. And it's a little bit of the, it's just so vibrant because it's sort of, it's got that angsty anger again.
Gavin, great to have you in. Always enjoy talking to you. Thanks for toning it down tonight. and happy birthday, pal. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Gavin Friday.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.